You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 13th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. A man brings a bit of style to the soccer pitch, and a woman whose fashion nous and sense of direction will keep those glossy pages turning. A subtle, sporty edition of The Stack is ready for kickoff. This week we'll be talking two genres of the magazine industry that you might think are poles apart, fashion and football. We'll find out how one publication brings them together when we meet Adam Toll, editor and creative director of the Green Soccer Journal. And we'll be meeting a one-woman intercontinental fashion and luxury publishing force as we welcome Gabrielle Hackworthy, editorial fashion director at Net-a-Porter. That's not all. We'll also be hearing from Doha, where local, regional and international culture is being redefined, thanks to brand new Aleph magazine.
I definitely thought that identifying the different cultural differences between each country would prove difficult, but this was what Aleph was really trying to tackle.
And from the Gulf, we'll be heading to Germany, where one magazine took a single, very long look at one street in particular in Berlin.
Flaneur is a magazine that portrays one street per issue, and the first has been Kantstraße, which is in Berlin, Charlottenburg.
That's all coming up today on The Stack, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 46 of The Stack here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House. As some of you may have already noticed by my accent, I'm not Tyler Brulé, your normal Stack host. I'm Tom Edwards, and this week I'll be taking you through some of the very best of print. There's a lot to get through over the next 52 or so minutes, so let's say hello to our guests on this miraculously summery Saturday right here in London. Very glad to welcome you to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. We welcome in studio two guests whose sectors of expertise on first appearances are rather different. Our first guest hails from Sydney, from where she launched a career in the world of fashion publishing. After working as a fashion stylist, fashion director, and creative consultant for various top titles, including Vogue Japan, Vogue China, Harper's Bazaar, and currently as editorial fashion director for Net-a-Porter, Gabrielle Hackworthy has become one of the key voices in the world of luxury publishing and marketing. Gabrielle, welcome to the programme. Thanks for joining us today. I guess an observer of your sort of recent career would say, hey, this is a bit of a surprising change from some very established names on the publishing side to a bit of a different venture. I suppose the first question is, how's it treating you?
Well, initially people were saying, oh, you're going to the dark side now, because the publishing, fashion media, they, you know, consider themselves to be the be-all and end-all of publishing. And then, you know, the digital platform has arrived, and really I think Net-a-Porter are the leaders in creating a new brand of publishing online. So I wouldn't have gone into the digital world unless I thought I could create the same level of content that I was creating in print, but I just wanted to do it online because I can reach a much larger audience. I mean, you know, working for Harper's Bazaar UK, I think our circulation was a little over 100,000. Now I work for Net-a-Porter. We have a weekly digital magazine called The Edit. It goes to 1.6 million subscribers globally. And we have an additional 5 million unique visitors that come to the site that are free to, you know, browse the magazine as well. So for me, it's a much more powerful voice and a global voice. And that's what interested me the most.
We'll talk a bit more about that. I guess it's a sort of established battle now between traditional, if you like, print in inverted commas, and these new media, because it's such a sort of hot issue. I just wondered, in terms of your own personal experience, though, have you found that the kind of editorial nous that you have, those skills, do they transfer? Because some people sort of think of these two disciplines as being themselves very, very different. But do you find that the kind of sensibilities you need as an editor, that kind of editorial voice you need to communicate to your readers, or whether they're online or in print, Do you find that's an easy transition, or was it something you were very aware of as you made the move?
I mean, the difference between the way I approached my work for Net-a-Porter online versus a traditional magazine like Vogue or Bazaar is that is the pace. It's, you know, we're a weekly magazine, so we have a weekly deadline rather than a monthly deadline, and we're still shooting all the world's top celebrities. So trying to wrangle 52 of the world's most popular women a year versus 12, which we did, at Bazaar or at Vogue, it's just the pace is so much faster, and, you know, you don't have time to sit on ideas. It's just yes, no the whole time. And, you know, in terms of production, it's like a bullet train that just keeps going, and you just have to grab on and hope you can stay on.
Cling on for dear life,
yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you should maybe try setting up a 24-hour radio station, see how that pays a good with you. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Also joining us around the table today is Adam Toll. Now in its third year, Adam is co-founder of a magazine that's really broken boundaries with some cutting-edge fashion and a refreshingly stylish look at a world previously dominated by some rather stereotypical coverage at times. The Green Soccer Journal has revolutionised the world of football in print. Adam, welcome to the show as well. Thanks for joining us. Am I being unfair there? Do you think that there is still that sense that football or soccer, as many of our listeners will know it, needed a bit of a kick. It needed a new view.
We had no experience in publishing. We basically, it's been a learning curve from day one, and we just wanted to develop stories that we wanted to read. And with an extension of that, we sort of applied fashion to it as well. From myself and James, my business partner, we come from a creative background, very visual, and I think that comes through with the content.
And Adam, I mean, that's interesting. I just wondered then, you sort of, I guess you go into it with the confidence then almost of a bit of naivety about
it. Yeah, pure naivety.
You're not aware of the problems. How's it sort of treated you as it's sort of grown? Because it's been received extremely well.
Yeah.
Did you find that kind of vindicated those early judgments? Or do you still have that sense of trepidation about, you know, you're kind of breaking barriers as you go?
There's still a sense of that trepidation for sure. I mean, especially with the new issue, it's a relaunch, a restructure, a redesign, you know, and so it was almost like starting all over again. So we were worried that we're going to alienate a crowd that were perhaps used to seeing a certain product. I mean, I think it looks a little bit more commercial. That was our focus. We wanted to take it to a new tier. It's only twice a year, so we wanted to make it bigger. 6 months is a long shelf life, so you have to have something quite substantial.
Absolutely. Well, we'll be talking more about the specifics of your redesign a little bit later. But I think it's always an interesting moment when you have a redesign, because there is that sense, as you said, of a big change. You worry about alienating people. Gabriel, I just wondered briefly, in your sort of experience through magazines, what was your attitude when it came to, say, you know, a big redesign, a big change? Was it something that, as being the editorial voice, you could be very excited about because it was new and it was changed? And how did you generally, is it easy to balance that with that fear of making changes, you know, the old adage of, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it? Or were you always so enthusiastic that that concern was always overcome?
I think the only time we would ever look at redesigning is when our competitors were emulating us. So on one hand, it was always, you know, very flattering. But on the other hand, when they started looking too similar, we'd always feel like we would have to take a next step forward. But no, we would never do a complete redesign. It would always be done incrementally, and we'd look at it in a very kind of, thoughtful way and think, why are we redesigning this? Because as you won't fix something if it's not broken, but if you can improve it, or if you can enhance the reader experience, or make it more serviceable, or make it more beautiful, then of course we'd take those steps. But a redesign for the sake of redesign is probably not a great business decision.
So Adam, with the look at the Soccer Journal, it is a big change all in one go. I mean, readers familiar with your its former incarnation, if you like, will immediately spot, you know, in terms of the paper stock, the size, the feel, the size of the sheer amount of pages. It is a big change. Do you think that you retained that fearlessness that you talked about before? Was that also in all of your minds when you made the change? You just thought, hey, let's be bold, let's go for something really, you know, a really arresting difference.
That was important when we, you know, we made the decision to redesign. I mean, the reason we did redesign it was because we didn't, you know, when we started the magazine, we really didn't, you know, we made decisions purely based on because we felt that was the right decision. Whether that was the right decision 3 years later, you know, we weren't to know that. Now we felt like, you know, if we were going to expand onto the newsstand, we needed a bolder logo. You know, the logo before was quite dainty. It didn't have a lot of presence. So that was the main sort of concern for us. We also were conscious of the fact that there are so many niche titles now, and sometimes they can look quite similar. And we felt like we were maybe just another title on the newsstand or in the stores. And so we wanted to include this kind of illustration that combined with the photography just to give ourselves a bit more personality. But you know, this is us now for the next 2-3 years.
Fantastic.
Or the next change.
Well, it certainly seems like job well done thus far. From my general reading around, even a lot of your existing fans still seem to be very, very happy indeed. And as I said, we'll take a bit more of an in-depth look at the redesign in a few minutes. Maybe more from Adam and from Gabrielle coming to you as we go through the hour here on The Stack. But up next, we'll actually be heading off to Qatar. Now to a flourishing region when it comes to magazine publishing, the Middle East and in particular the Gulf States. The tiny nation of Qatar has been punching far above its demographic and geographic weight for some years now. Due to hold the World Cup, of course, in 2018, the country has used vast oil revenue to invest in all aspects of culture, including sport, to levels that many European or American curators and directors can often only dream of. And now a new bi-monthly publication hopes to bring the best of regional trends and cultural trends to Qatar, but also export some of the Gulf's hidden talent internationally. Earlier this week, I met the people behind Aleph magazine. Founder Jack Thomas Taylor and editor Lima Bashmi were keen to tell me that there's a lot more to Qatar than camels and oil.
The term culture has been overused and people think that culture is just art and design. And we did a bit of research and we realised that culture is so much more. It's so much more than just art and design and maybe architecture and things that fall under that word. And we met with a lot of people in Qatar and a lot of people internationally as well. And through my connections with Bahrain and the UAE as well, we were able to talk to people and they said that the culture was art and design to them as well. And we were like, well, this needs to change because culture is food, it's sports, it's music, it's lifestyle. It's all of these things that people, it's almost like a trend, that it's a following. From that research, we were able to take all of this information and package it into a magazine that is it both in English and Arabic. And it really puts Qatar and the whole GCC. And when I say GCC, for those that don't know, it's Qatar, Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. So these countries all share very similar cultures, although they are still very different, but there was such a gap in the market to do such magazine. So we came up with the concept, and as the name is Aleph, which is the first letter of the Arabic alphabet, and we worked with a design studio who incorporates both the English A and then the Arabic A as well, the Arabic letter for Aleph. And within the magazine, we broke it down into different sections, which play on the human senses. So we have touch, which is everything to do with design. Then we have taste, which is everything to do with a drink or a food or how people using their mouth to taste different cuisines in the Middle East. And we also have speak. So that's when we sit down with people and have different interviews from artists right through to ambassadors and diplomats. And then we have other sections such as see, which is when people, rather than calling it a travel section, we can go and see different countries. So in the first issue, we have Oman and we look at Kumza, which is a place which is, you can only get to it by boat. And all the people there are so different to the other Arab world. They even speak their own dialect of Arabic and their own different words.
It's really interesting that you've broken it down that way. I just wonder, talking of things that are broken down into their different compartments, when you're talking about, you know, the Gulf region and the culture, I mean, Jack, you were reflecting on this already. Is it a challenge, do you think, to have a magazine that represents all of these different component parts? Or did you find, when you're actually putting the magazine together, that actually it does all come together very easily. There are these trends and trails that run throughout all of these different communities and cultures. I guess there's regional variations, but did you find that it does sit easily together?
To begin with, I definitely thought that identifying the different cultural differences between each country would prove difficult because I found them quite similar myself, and I being myself as a Bahraini. But then again, when you look at the cultural icons, this was what Elif was really trying to tackle, which is breaking this misconception that we're only about, let's say, camels, oil, sand and tents and all of these icons, and trying to identify ourselves in different ways. So, for example, jewelry design and fashion design, you could see prevalent in the UAE, whereas food and fashion would be more prevalent in Kuwait. Saudis have quite an emerging art scene. So all that kind of beautifully came together and kind of built a social fabric to identify different locations and separate them even more, but at the same time bring them with a strong national identity.
Now, we're obviously big fans and we like to think aficionados of all things print here at Monocle. And I just wondered, when we're looking at the magazine, it's broken down, as you've mentioned before, both of you, into these sections. I always like to have a good feel of the magazine. It's lovely, heavy stock. How much of that was, in terms of your planning process, as well as the content, the actual, the feel, the look, you mentioned the design agencies. What was the kind of overarching vision? Was it about reflecting all of this change, all of this vibrancy that was there? Was that first and foremost, even when it came to how it feels and how it reads?
Definitely. We worked with a local creative agency called Studio 28, and they're named after the letters of the Arabic alphabet. So there are 28 letters to the Arabic alphabet. And we found that it would be very important to work with a contemporary Arab design firm to pull together a brand identity for Elif magazine that would reflect that. When they designed the logo and they designed the identity, we felt that it should maintain both a local contemporary feel that was switched on, and Jack was part of the team to actually brief them on these details. Even the concepts of the five different sections and the quality of the paper, which is actually recycled, was all part of the deal of working with it. We also worked with a printing press in London, but we hope to have everything secured and done and executed from Doha and the Middle East and GCC.
For me, for instance, you touched on the size, and the size was something that was interesting for us because we knew we had to get it right. We knew that we are in this digital age, and at the moment, our digital plan was not to have a digital plan. And it's funny because you'll walk around the airports of maybe Qatar or Dubai, and you see three-year-olds there with their iPads flicking through YouTube videos on games, on Angry Birds, on all of these different things. And we were like, okay, so our magazine needs to be the size of an iPad. In terms of the paper, we knew that within Qatar, within the whole GCC, that government organizations are a big part of paving this cultural landscape. And to work with government organizations, we knew that their main remit is to be sustainable. So we realized that we need to be on 100% recycled paper. In terms of the page numbers, it increased over time. We originally said our first issue will be 40-odd pages. We then went to 80 pages. Now we're at 88 pages. Our next issue is already 104 pages. So it's something that we had a plan, but we didn't, I will be really honest, we didn't realise we'd be so successful so quickly.
That was my conversation with Jack Thomas-Taylor and Lima Bashmi of Aleph magazine. A nice problem to have, being so successful so quickly. You're with The Stack here on Monocle 24. I'll be back with Gabrielle Hackworthy and Adam Toll right after this. You're with The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. We're going to delve into our guests' stacks of magazines in just a moment. But it was interesting hearing about Qatar and the magazine culture there. I just wondered very, very briefly, Gabrielle, in terms of when you sort of break down the world region by region, and I guess without wanting to be too kind of statistical about how Net-a-Porter sort of divides and rules the world, how aware are you as you sort of consider editorial direction of the conflicting demands of these different areas? I mean, look at the Gulf states, potentially so very lucrative. Is it a real challenge to kind of maintain a kind of coherent level of editorial control over what are very sort of different challenges in these different markets?
When we were thinking about the edit and the editorial content, we thought, do we need to be local as well as global? And we did a significant amount of research, and what we found was our audience were global. They were all traveling so much, and really they were coming to us for a global view. So we don't really try and localize the content at all. And really that's why they're coming to us, because, you know, we found out that, you know, the woman in Tokyo wants to read the same article that the woman in Paris, that the woman in Washington does. And at that level that we're pitching our audience, you know, they're very interested in fashion, in art, in culture, and they have a very global perspective on the world. So that's where our content is directed towards.
And Adam, it's interesting, obviously people talk about football as this great sort of global unifier, the language, if you will, that you can speak wherever you go in the world. Are you always conscious of that with when you're sort of running through your, you know, your story lists for the magazine? Is it something where you just want to reflect the global basis of the game? Are you always confident that the story of interest in Sao Paulo will be as relevant in Seville or in Shanghai? Do you feel that you're dealing with a subject that also has that kind of global, it translates globally perfectly?
I think that's the beauty of football. I mean, it's, you know, it's such a global sport. It's ridiculous how far reach you can get with that. I mean, we try not to be so London-centric because it can be easy to do that. But obviously we don't have the budgets to get around the world quite so easily. So, you know, we cheat some ways. We've got a lot of contributors who want to work with us, who live around the world in all sorts of places. And you know, Stefan Ruiz, who we've worked with since issue one, is, you know, extremely global and always sending us projects that he wants to do. And, you know, especially in Brazil, you know, he's always in Brazil. I mean, we've got a big sort of exhibit of his work in the new issue as well. So
I guess you're lucky in London in some ways that the football world does quite often come to London. You have the likes of, you know, Oscar, Chelsea, but a little bit too much Chelsea, just in my humble opinion in the current issue. But it's such a kind of central hub, isn't it, London now? The Premier League is such a kind of, has such global reach. A lot of these characters pitch up on the shore. So I guess the football world comes to you in some respects.
Yeah, it makes it much easier for us, certainly.
And just looking back at the Gulf area, obviously Qatar, you know, will be hosting the World Cup in a few years' time. Is that kind of like a dream pitch for you? Is that way too far down the line to think about? Would you already sort of idly wonder, oh, I wonder what a fresh take on that would be?
We're still thinking about Brazil, so that's way too far advanced for us. But I do think it's an interesting, I mean, it's caused a lot of controversy over the bid initially. I don't know, you know, there's a lot of political aspects to it, but I probably won't want to delve into. But, you know, even the heat that is, you know, the humidity is going to pose such problems for the players. So they're thinking about moving it to December so that the climate's cooler. But that's obviously in the middle of the domestic season when most of the players will be utilised. So it's going to be a tricky situation.
Right. And it doesn't seem right to a traditionalist myself.
Not at all.
A winter tournament. Also, it's not like England need help. Hotter way. If it was cold, if it was played in the Arctic, we might have half a chance. We'll consider that a little more later. Let's start by actually delving in then to the stacks of magazines that you have with you today. Gabriel, let's start with you. What's one of, is it one of your perhaps former titles you want to start with, or just maybe another one that grabbed you as you looked at the newsstand?
Obviously, a lot of my magazines I've chosen today are fashion magazines, and I thought I would start with probably what most people consider to be the fashion Bible, which is American Vogue. And the reason I love American Vogue is because the production quality and the way they execute their shoots and the level of production value that goes into the magazine is above and beyond any other magazine, probably because they have the biggest budgets in the world. So they can afford...
That always helps, I
yes,
think, generally.
They can afford to take Mario Testino via helicopter to Saint-Tropez at a moment's notice. But I think that all creates the most aspirational and global view of fashion, but, you know, told in a very narrative way. And I think... And what Anna does, Anna Winter, the editor-in-chief, does, is she always finds the stories in the women and not just the clothes. So they don't just create a story around, I don't know, the pencil skirt. It's like the pencil skirt presented on the hottest actress with a slant towards a kind of cinematic narrative, and it's all packaged so nicely in a way that you're getting the fashion information, you're being entertained, you're being inspired, and you're presented with the most amazing visuals.
Let's take a look. So what's the current issue that you have that you've got with you there?
This is the June 2013. The other thing I like about American Vogue is they really champion new models. They break new models. And they also transform people. You know, the cover girl on this issue is Kate Upton, who a year ago was an internet sensation because she was filmed at a football match doing a dance called the Doogie. And now she's on the cover of American Vogue. And I like the way that, you know, Anna understands that there are some celebrities that do across all parts of society, and she's really reaching out for it to be a mass market magazine, but done in a very beautiful and very elegant way. So she's taken a girl who essentially is, you know, the Doogie girl, and made her into a goddess and put it on the cover. The other thing I like about American Vogue is they do an age issue and they do a shape issue. So it's not all 16-year-old, you know, skinny models. They do talk to a much larger audience, metaphorically speaking.
Absolutely. And I just want, I mean, Adam, it's interesting because obviously one of the challenges, I guess, that you've faced and tackled very cleverly, I think, with Green Soccer Journal is to sort of integrate some of these elements about fashion, whether it be a sensitivity in terms of how you're presenting the images, right down to actually, you know, covering fashion, tying it in with football, and, you know, realizing these things are not exclusive and it's okay for people to read the magazine and appreciate both of those elements. Do you look to the likes of Vogue, these established players? I mean, how does this issue, for example, grab you when you first see that? Do you see ideas that you'd like to borrow from? Do you get inspiration from that, or do you still see it as a very different kind of animal from what you're doing?
I don't think it's that different. I mean, you know, like, footballers are celebrities, so we have that celebrity aspect. I mean, from a design perspective, you know, I'm obsessed with cover lines at the moment. That's why I introduced it into this one. I wanted it to appeal to a more commercial market. Like I said, celebrities are so important, and, you know, the press that we've generated from our Ashley Cole cover, you know, has been incredible for us. So it's definitely sort of like a key link for us.
I was going to say, I mean, Ashley Cole to Seasoned Observers of Football is certainly at least as divisive a figure as Kate Upton. How much of a sort of consideration do you give that then? When you're looking at, you mentioned sort of newsstand presence when looking at, you know, cover lines and your logos. Is that still your starting point with the magazine? Are you thinking about how does this hit someone who's walking past a newsstand? Is that your consideration before you even get onto sort of, you know, market industry figures and, you know, experts in their field? Do you look for newsstand presence first and foremost still?
With this issue we have, because we just want to expand, you know, we have to expand to keep going. You know, it's important to you know, build a bigger audience and generate more income just to keep the project alive more than anything. You know, and if we can add little aspects like that, you know, then I'm, you know, more for it, really.
Fantastic. Adam, let's delve into your stack of magazines today. I'm hoping there's a few with a bit more of a kind of a sporting bent. I think it looks like we're not going to be disappointed. Where will we start? Where do you want to start today?
Well, I brought Slam magazine, which is a US basketball magazine. And the only reason I bought this in is because it's a complete alternative to what we deliver. But I'm still totally attracted to this magazine. You know, the photography is so commercial. The approach is completely different to us. And it's refreshing for me to see something from that perspective.
Just lean across to grab it there. Again, this is sort of arresting cover. Very glossy. It's very loud, very direct. And what is it about Slam? Is this sort of one of your regular required readings?
It's not so regular for me. I mean, I just started picking it up because I was interested in the commercial aspects of sports magazines. One thing I did pick up is, like, I've always been quite conscious of how many times can we photograph a footballer? You know, will that ever get boring? And what I've noticed from Slam, I mean, it's been going for 25 years and they pretty much had the same formula for 25 years. And so to adopt that, some of those habits and traits, you know, it might give us a bit of longevity.
We mentioned it earlier, but they're obviously subscribers to If It Ain't Broke, Don't Fix It. We'll be back very shortly with a report from Germany, where magazine Flaneur has decided to devote all of its energy and attention to picking apart just one city street per issue. First up for them was Berlin's Kantstrasse. Welcome back. This is The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Last October, Monocle 24's weekly programme on cities, The Urbanist, produced a documentary all about Berlin's Augustrasse. While recording that show, they'd run into a young woman named Ricarda Messner. She mentioned she was planning a magazine with a similar concept. Each issue would be about one street. Her magazine, Flaneur, launched on June the 6th, and the first issue covers Kantstrasse in West Berlin. Subtitled Fragments of a Street, the biannual Flaneur takes a close, rather unconventional look at Kantstrasse's legends, people and history with artsy design and an almost literary experimental editorial approach. Nothing here is obvious, and the magazine is full of surprises. It even has its own soundtrack. In Berlin, Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley chatted with Messner and editor-in-chief Fabian Saul about what the magazine hoped to accomplish.
Flaneur is a magazine that portrays one street per issue. And the first has been Kantstrasse, which is in Berlin, Charlottenburg.
Why did you choose Kantstrasse?
Well, for me, it has been a personal decision. I'm actually from Berlin. I was born there and I grew up in this neighborhood in the area. And I've been traveling back and forth between New York and Berlin. And then, I don't know, I came back in 2011 and I just started walking around a lot in my own neighborhood, and then I decided to pay more attention to it and chose Kantstrasse.
Then Christina and me came in later, so the decision for Kantstrasse was already made. And for us, because we both live in Kreuzberg and Mitte, it was like kind of a new neighborhood to explore, and which made it very interesting for us to work there.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you came up with this micro examination of an urban thoroughfare, essentially. What did you discover? Why did you go in so close? Was it different than what you expected when you started the project?
You know, you're right saying that a street is a very narrow concept also for a magazine. But actually, when you take a street, you find the multiple layers and the multiple fragments. It's a good framework for depth and variety of content.
I think because Ricarda said, when you walk around and just perceive your surrounding, the perception is always fragmented, and I think it is always subjective. And I think by taking this microcosm, we're kind of embracing the fact that it's like that, and we're not trying to find excuses and trying to make it objective or trying to find the facts, you know. We were very aware of that. There's always a mix of facts and fiction, and we tried to embrace that. The magazine consists of very subjective individual approaches to Kantstrasse, so we have a variety from architects, illustrators, photographers, directors, authors, writers, and each story somehow takes just an aspect of the street. But the whole concept, also from the visual perspective, is made all these little elements are related to each other, and that there is some kind of storytelling without being it narrative or consistent.
Can you give me an example? We can actually open the magazine and take a look.
So probably Traces of Resistance is a quite good example to see how we worked. So this is the a story pretty much about different lives on Kantstrasse. They're linked by a certain aspect of resistance, and they're linked through the street. We found all these relations, but also the dissonant aspects of them, and pretty much told a story that is at the border of facts and fiction. So there's a lot of research involved, but at the same time, it is very literal. And the whole magazine has a very literal approach.
You've also got some photo stories. There's one in a bar. Could you tell me a little bit about how that was shot and how you came up with the idea?
Yeah, that was our place where we always met. It's called Goldener Löffel. It's actually at the very end of Kantstrasse. And Maxim Ballesteros shot this night. And actually, we came there always together. It actually just portrays the life and in this case, the community and people of Kantstrasse.
Let's go to the more business end of things. How did you guys finance this?
Advertisement is always the key, or hopefully always the key, to finance. And if you have a look in the magazine, they're all in the back. It's mostly culture and also art-related institution who financed this. But I was very happy that not even from the contributor part, but even from the advertising and finance part, that there has been a lot of support. We were able to go to print.
How's it selling?
really good. I mean, we launched on June 6th, so it has been now 3.5 weeks. Obviously, you know, it's the beginning and the content starts in Berlin, so here it's selling really well, and we're also trying to involve the local shops, so you can find us even on the street and the side streets. But now we're also in Stockholm, London, New York, and we also have a PayPal account, and I don't know, we have orders from Brazil, from Australia, from Romania, and I don't even know how they already know about us, but they do, and it's all over the world with the limited edition, yeah, of 1,000 copies.
Do you think that this magazine reflects a larger societal movement to pay far more attention to the local?
I don't know if it's really the local. It's just the general development of paying more attention to details and about, you know, sitting down and about engaging into conversations with people and looking out for anecdotes and, taking some time off.
I guess the title Flaneur reflects that as well, because the flaneuring compared to, like, if you go for a walk, you can basically only do that on your own, which sets you in the position that you're, like, way more, you pay more attention because you're not in you're in a dialogue with your surrounding rather than a dialogue with someone else, and you're also in dialogue with yourself very much. So I think that enables finding those, like, hidden layers, seeing those layers. It is always about, like, also traveling back in history, because all these dynamic layers of a city are, like, built over years, and it takes some time to, like, reveal them.
That was Monocle's Berlin correspondent Kimberly Bradley chatting to Ricarda Messner of Flaneur magazine from Germany. Welcome back to this 46th edition of The Stack on Monocle 24. My name's Tom Edwards, and today I'm very lucky to be joined by two great guests. Gabrielle Hackworthy, who is Editorial Fashion Director for Net-a-Porter, and Adam Toll, co-founder, editor, and creative director of the Green Soccer Journal. We were talking a little bit earlier about, I guess, periods of sort of transition for both of you in some ways. Adam, the big redesign, which I want to talk about in a bit more detail, and Gabrielle as well, that the transition, I guess, between print media and digital, and how they sit together. How important is it for you as a sort of a person with that editorial grounding, you know, to engage with change? Do you find that it's something? Do you ever worry that you perhaps get set in your ways in certain magazine work? Do you find there's a need to freshen up your thinking, to freshen up your approach? Or are you always fairly confident that you can bring that kind of freshness of view, that sort of new perspective to your tasks without actually physically having to change your location or change your job? How important is that kind of the role of change in what you do?
I mean, luckily for me, I work in the fashion industry, and the fashion is all about change. The fashion, you know, trends, they change every 6 months, if not every 3 months, because we have, pre-fall and resort collections now. So we're constantly being pushed to look at things differently and to do things differently and to look forward. You know, I think it's important with, you know, in terms of magazine publishing, you know, you have your roots and you have one foot maybe steeped in history and in tradition, and, you know, I think there is a sort of editorial integrity that you need to maintain, but then you take that and then you develop it and then you add the whole digital aspect on top of that, and it becomes a really exciting arena because, you know, in terms of bringing the content to life, you can do that digitally, which you can't do on the printed page. And there's so many other things we can do in terms of enhancing the reader experience. You know, we can embed videos, we can, you know, in terms of showing product, we can turn it around, we can show multiple products, we can put interviews within the pages. So I just think digitally allows us to enhance, you know, the reader experience.
And what role do you think going forwards that traditional print will play in that? Is there a place in the strategy for, you know, for a magazine, a dedicated specifically print product? Is that something that you are sort of interested in doing? Does it, I mean, still plays a role, or is this something that works better in the sort of digital realm only?
I mean, I think in terms of publishing and your brand, it's really important to have both. You need to have a presence on the newsstand, but then you also need to have a digital presence because, you know, I think print, everyone says print's dead, it's dying, and to a certain degree it's maybe not as popular as it was, but there is still a huge affection for print we've found within the fashion industry at least and within our readership. They love print. It's a much more emotional experience than flicking through a, you know, on your iPad or mobile device. And we believe that people still engage with print, but at the same time, we want to have a digital experience that's equally, if not more, exciting. And, you know, you can engage in that in different ways.
So let's come back to this sense of transition then, Adam and Green Soccer Journal. I've sort of alluded to a couple of things before. The new volume, it's kind of glossier, it's thicker. You mentioned your new logo with some sort of background artwork as well behind the photography. We were talking about the importance of that immediate impact. When you're plotting, as you said, especially with something that's a relatively infrequent publication, content-wise, you were looking for impact on newsstand. How did you decide to sort of fill the rest of the magazine? Because you had the luxury of time, I guess, to plan it and make sure you got it right. What were the key considerations for you and the rest of the team? Were there any battles, for example, any disagreements, or did it all come together in a fairly sort of nice, organic, comfortable way?
No, it was fairly boring and organic. I mean,
that must have been a bit of a scrap.
We were conscious that we wanted people to navigate through the magazine clearly. Before, we felt like it was just page to page to page. This time we've developed new sections which are dedicated to, I mean, even at the back we've got a more sort of product related section which we haven't really focused on before. The front section is called Season Review, and it's kind of an abstract view of the season that's previously passed. So we invite artists and photographers to sort of, you know, have their view on it and demonstrate it through their means. And then obviously it's profiles are pretty much standard. You know, that's the standard practice in kind of sports profiles. But yeah.
And just tell me, I mean, I know you probably, like a parent with its offspring, you probably love all the different constituent parts equally. But are there any bits that you're particularly sort of proud and excited about getting out there in this redesign? I mean, not just the overall look, were there any features where you thought, hey, this is really true to what our objectives were when we got started, and I'm really kind of proud of it? Were there any particular sort of highlights that you'd pick out for us?
I think the cover stories, you know, it was a big deal for us to be able to work with someone, you know, the photographers like Sean and Seng, who... I couldn't imagine, you know, guys like Sean and Seng working with a football magazine maybe a year ago, 6 months ago, you know, so that was a slight departure from what we'd previously done. I think the first section, you know, Season Review, is kind of abstract. It's very engaging. You know, it's a lot of thought that's gone into how we tell those stories in that first section. It's not so obvious to the reader maybe, and I think that's, you know, we were purposefully projecting that kind of attitude.
And just in terms of the sort of rival publications, there's not many people doing what you're doing, but there's a couple of interesting comparisons, I guess, to make. I mean, there's like Howler, the US soccer magazine, which is always very popular, people mention on the stack. Do you, when you look at the sort of these other titles doing similar things to what you're doing, how do you consider them? Are they rivals? Are they perhaps... do you take inspiration? Do you sometimes look at them and think, oh, that looks a bit like something we did before? What's the sort of nature of that relationship? How would you characterise it?
There's no rivalry because we're just an alternative point of view, basically, you know. And, you know, there's this Blizzard, which, you know, it's very sort of long journalism. You know, that's an alternative to 442. When Saturday Comes is more of a fanzine kind of. So I think we're all doing something very different. And I think, you know, a football fan can buy all of those magazines.
And Gabriel, I just wanted to ask you on that point. When you're working in some of these big titles, we know there's, I guess, an element of rivalry. You talked about the cover stars. It's such a sort of competitive marketplace. Was it the same dynamic? Was it as sort of respectful and amiable as that? Or was it rather more, I don't want to say, you know, sort of stabbing in the back or anything, but I mean, what was the relationship like? Was it something that you all approached with relish, or did you find it was actually a more stressful kind of relationship?
I think... you know, on a personal level, in term, I can, you know, I can speak for the British press because I'm part of it. Everyone's really friendly, and we're all actually quite good mates, and we really respect what we all do. And
most of the time, right?
Most of the time. I mean, obviously, the rivalry comes from the fact that we're all after the same ad dollar from the same brand. So yes, but that's on a sort of on a business side. But you know, I think rivalry is healthy in any industry.
Very, very diplomatically put. Well, we'll be talking about that more in a moment. I'm still with Gabriel Hatworthy and Adam Toll. We're going to be delving back into their stack of magazines right after this.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Without further ado, let's get back to our stacks of magazines. I think we should run through a few. Let's get the pace going. Let's start, Gabriel, where do you want to look next? I mean, you've got some pretty arresting looking magazines. Any that's really jumped out at you recently?
Well, on the side, you know, we're talking so much about design and redesign and how design is a hugely important when looking at branding your magazine. For me, one of the most genius designs is by Fabien Baron for Interview magazine. He's probably, you know, the benchmark art director and designer for magazines. He redesigned Harper's Bazaar when Liz Tilberis was the editor in the 90s, and now he's taken over Interview as the creative director and editor-in-chief. And I think what he does is he really embraces typography. The words are as important as the images to him, and he doesn't see them as separate entities, and they always work together. And he has managed to, you know, compile a roster of the world's best photographers and stylists and, you know, celebrities and writers on, you know, very little budget, because it is a niche independent magazine. But what I love about Interview is they will ask a film director like Wim Wenders to write an essay on a fashion designer like Yohji Yamamoto, or they will ask Florence Welch to review the new Baz Luhrmann movie. So there's that kind of cross-cultural pollination that happens in the Interview section. And they all, I mean, it's called Interview, but essentially it's one person from one area of culture interviewing a person from a different area. And I think that always creates a really great read.
What do you make of that one, Adam? Is that one that you would that sort of leap out at you from newsstands, or yeah, is it a favourite already?
I was just saying off air I was going to bring Interview in as well. So,
great minds think alike. let's maybe have one more magazine each. Adam, what's another one you've got there? Elle Decoration, I see.
Yeah, I mean this is the only magazine I subscribe to, and it's the only magazine where I actually can sit down and just relax with. Like it sounds bad, but it's the only magazine that doesn't inspire me. I can just completely switch off. You know, since, you know, creating this publication, the Green Soccer Journal, it's like every magazine can trigger a thought pattern or inspire you in some way. You know, you can't go to bed and relax with the magazine the same way.
Are you sad about that in some ways? Do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
Has it kind of almost taken some of the magic away? Because every time you see something new, you necessarily reflect it onto your own experience.
Yeah, that's why I like Elle Decoration, because I can just sit down and enjoy it. It's simple communication. It's very safe design. It's not particularly inspiring. You know, it's not my rooms don't look like what you see in our decoration. You know, it's a complete apartamento, which provides us with something completely different, which my probably apartment could look better in. But yeah, I mean, it's aspirational. It's just, yeah, it's just, I can switch off and relax with it.
It's your nice comforting cup of tea.
That's correct.
Of magazines. And Gabrielle, what about you? Have you got any more in your stack today?
Well, as the complete antithesis to The Gentlewoman, I have French Vogue, which is unabashedly in love with sex and sexualizing women. But I love that they're brave enough to do that. It's probably the only women's, you know, commercial title on the newsstand where you can still show a woman smoking and, you know, they're not afraid of nudity. I mean, I don't think we've seen, you know, a pair of breasts in American Vogue since 1976 or something, you know. But in French Vogue, it's kind of a constant theme. But I quite like that. I like that they've got a point of view and they stick to it. And, you know, the women are always really fierce, really empowered. And it's just, you know, they know who they are and they consistently deliver that message. And, you know, not everyone, it's not going to be for everyone. But certainly if you like their aesthetic, then they're delivering it month after month.
It's interesting, isn't it? Just to kind of finish off, I guess, we talked about these various themes of a transition. It's interesting looking at magazines that, as you say, completely unashamedly pursue a successful formula and they stick with it. Just as a final thought, we touched upon it briefly. I mean, in terms of the visionaries, some of these pioneering people behind magazines, maybe they are still out there. I mean, are you still very confident in terms of not just the robustness of the marketplace for magazines, but also the kind of these big editorial drivers, the people who are going to be being bold, maybe being innovative, are they still there? Do they still have the opportunity, perhaps, to do the kinds of brave decisions that they took in the past? Or do you think that the rigors of the marketplace, the demands of the market mean that maybe people don't have that luxury anymore? What's your sort of overview of it, you know, when you look at how maybe the next sort of 3, 4, 5 years?
I think the most, the most unique and most interesting titles are not going to come out of traditional publishing houses. They're going to come from independent titles or from new publishers, you know, like Net-a-Porter, where, you know, they're not publishers at all. They're e-tailers and they've decided to set up a publishing division. So I think that's where we're looking. They look at publishing in a completely different way because they're not confined by, you know, tradition or by the way things were done. They're coming at it from a completely different angle. And so I think that's the way you'll find innovation in print media in the future.
And Adam, for you as like something of an innovator yourself, are you still excited by being in that vanguard? We talked about it before. It was very bold and you had the fearlessness of being an innovator, I guess. As the magazine grows, which it has done and continues to be so successful as it is, Do you still think that you'll be able to retain that kind of hunger? Do you think someone following you and trying to do the same kind of project, if they come onto the scene in 2, 3, 4 years, will they be able to make it work?
I think so. And I think, you know, I agree with what Gabrielle was saying earlier about, you know, niche titles are the voice now. You know, they're trying new things, you know, subject matters that you wouldn't find in perhaps mainstream titles are finding a voice. So I don't see why that shouldn't continue, no.
Fantastic. Well, that's a lovely upbeat note to finish on. That brings us to the end of edition 46 of The Stack from Midori House in London. My guests today have been Gabrielle Hackworthy and Adam Toll. Our producer was David Pleasant. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And in the studio, behind the glass, was Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we'll be back next Saturday at the very same time. You can, of course, always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, in place of Tyler Brulé, it's goodbye and have a very good weekend.